Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the black radio networks that focus on the situation of our issues, presents tonight Black Urban America. People that are listening from laptop, if you have a comment or a question, you could dial 516-531-9540. That's 516-531-9540. And press 1. The lineup, as usual, tonight, Black Urban America. I'm your host, Kenny Jones, with my whole co-host, Michonne Williams. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne Williams. On Thursday, we have Port of Harlem with Wayne Young. And on Saturday, we have Provocative Thought with Culture Speed. Now, do you think that lawyers can assist blacks without liberation? Do you think that the criminal justice system is fair to black folks? Well, to help us to discuss this issue, we have a special guest, the administrative law judge from the state of California, the Honorable Margie Melvin. Good evening, Your Honor.
Good evening, Kenneth Jones and Michonne Williams. I am so happy to be with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you loud.
Excellent. And I want to first start off by telling both of you that I am so impressed and grateful that black folk are taking media into their own hands, and I love that you all are producing a radio show that gives us content and information that we as black people need to know. So I want to start off by saying that I do not any longer listen to the television networks, the cable networks for my news. I get my news primarily from new black media, such as yourself. So I want to start off by saying thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, to me,
it's a
mission, it's a journey, and to address these issues, to come up with solutions. I also, you know, tend to more or less go to black media. You know, Dr. Mm-hmm. Watkins. Urban X Excellent. Shout out to all of you brothers and sisters that put their time in, because it's not very easy, but we put our time in to help, you know, to solve a lot of problems and develop theories and philosophy to follow in solving our problems in the United States of America.
Well, that's it. That's it. That's what we need to do, and that's what we need to teach our children to do. You gather information from a multitude of sources, you review mm-hmm. it, you analyze it, and then you come to conclusions. So I commend you, and this is how I am teaching a child to analyze. It's important that we be analytical. So, but to answer your question, it is so loaded, and I could actually write a book about the question that you've presented. So let me start off by saying that when I went to law school, I knew early on that I wanted to go to law school to be a civil rights attorney. My goal was to have my own law firm and to take on companies and governmental entities that were hurting our people. I wanted to be a Johnny Cochran, the next Johnny Cochran. In fact, he was someone I looked up to, and he attended my law school. Having said that, life happens. As a first generation person to go to law school, I did not have all the knowledge I needed to excel in corporate America, in the big chip law firms. I was in a big chip law firm, and Kenneth, I ended up getting fired. And I can laugh about it now because I know that that wasn't the place for me. And right. I ultimately opened my own law firm. And when you're a new lawyer and you open your shingle, you take in what you can get. And right. So for me, that meant criminal defense. The state was needing a criminal defense panel of attorneys to take on these criminal defense matters. And so Kenneth and Michonne, I was a very young attorney, and they required that I go to a training. So I walk into a hotel room in downtown Los Angeles to take this training on how to become a criminal defense attorney, and I saw nothing but old white folk, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to myself, is this the place for me? I don't know about this. But Mama always told me, she said, you know, where you find white folks, there is money. So I knew that. And so I sat there and said, okay, I'm going to listen to this and see what it's all about and take on this training. I kid you not, a week after training, they sent me to California State Prison in Chino to meet with inmates and defend them. They gave me what's called a six-pack. Kenneth, I was terrified. Terrified.
Yeah, Chino ain't no joke. Chino ain't no joke, I heard.
No, it's no joke. Chino is no joke. It's a reception center. But within the prison, they have units that they designate, and it's called administrative segregation for highly dangerous inmates. And I was a young whippersnapper going into these prisons, and for whatever reason, the officers just let me right in there. And you're typically not supposed to let the attorneys or anybody on the tiers, but they let me in on a tier. So here I am, terrified, thinking that this is something that I can't do. And an old attorney who was kind of coaching me said, you know what? And I was crying. I left and I said, you know what? I can't do this. And he talked to me and he said, yes, you can do this. You can go back in there. He said, it's a little bit frightening right now because it's all new, but they need you. And so I went back in there, Kenneth, and really the rest is history. And let me tell you what I did. I represented inmates and parole revocation matters. And Kenneth, I don't like to brag on myself, but I became damn good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And from that experience, and when I say damn good, I pushed these white folk who were primarily older white people who had taken on jobs as deputy commissioners to essentially pad their retirement and just send us right back to prison every year. We get out on parole, send us right back. But I pushed the envelope and was really good at getting a lot of folks out. And to answer your question, it is so difficult to really answer in one word. But to answer it, no, we as lawyers cannot liberate our people through the criminal justice system because it is a system where we are
Let me ask you this. And thank you for saying that last sentence. It could lead up to my first question. Is there racism in the criminal justice system? I asked all the lawyers and judges that, and even the community activists. I always ask you that.
Kenneth, absolutely, 100%. Yes, 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 yes. And the saddest and the, I think, most difficult thing for me to grasp and accept is that sometimes it comes from our own. I recall representing a young woman, I think she's about 19 years old, who had a drug addiction problem. And she and I were meeting at a jail in LA County Jail. And she was telling me, you know, I got out of jail, went home to my mom, and my mom, the last apartment we had was gone, and I was devastated, and I couldn't find her, and I resorted back to using. And I said to myself, you know, sweetheart, and I'm 25. I said, I know I can get you out. It's just a drug issue. We're going to get you into a program. I know I can do this. So we went into the hearing, and I'm just feeling confident with this young lady having been in foster care, having been just released from jail and going back home and not finding her mother. They would understand her pain and put her in drug treatment rather than send her back to prison. I presented our appeal, our case. They sent this young lady back to prison for a year. Kenneth.
Wow.
I tell you, from that point forward, my thought process changed. I was never and am not a violent person. But in that moment, I am sitting before this white man who's Jewish, who I thought would understand the plight of black folk as, you know, Jewish people haven't experienced their own Holocaust. He sent her back to prison, and I wanted to knock him out. It took everything in my being to sit still until it was time to go and to go back to the cell with this young lady and to cry together. But from that point forward, I said that I am going to become a part of the system internally, and I am going to make changes within the system because I cannot do so outside of the system.
What type of changes that need to be made? What type of changes that need to be made in the criminal justice system? Because I feel personally, it's only my personal perspective, that the criminal justice is against black folks.
Absolutely. Undoubtedly,
no,
100% against black folks. Absolutely. But let me tell you something, Kenneth. When you are talking to a man or woman who's sat in prison for 30 years, and you, as a little girl from South Central LA, have the ability to release this person, even though it's not a multitude of people you can release, it makes a huge difference, a huge difference. And so I did that to the extent that I could. But to answer your question, to release us from prison for us to go back into the hell that really brought us there does no good. And I don't know if I'm answering your questions, Kenneth and Michonne, but I just kind of think that for the most part, it is very difficult for us to be truly liberated through the criminal justice system, even if it means multitudes of us getting released, because we're released back into hell. We're not, at least in the state of California, and in my opinion, the United States, we are not respected and we don't have full citizenship. Look at George Floyd. Look at the host of folks who, you know, after dealing with their drug addiction, after being released from prison, go right back into hell. And it's unlike Hunter Biden, who, after his issues with drug addiction, gets to write a memoir and gets to go consult with companies in Russia and make millions of dollars.
So let me ask you this, John. Let me ask you this. How can we motivate black lawyers to assist us in becoming independent?
Again, another excellent question. You know, when I was in law school, I took a course on, it was called think it was, I can't think of the name of the course, but the course dealt with liberating people. How do you truly liberate people? How do you use systems to liberate people? And it centered around a three-prong approach, and that was litigation, that was protest and civil disobedience, and that was legislation. And to a certain extent, I believe that we have to continue with all three of those. It's just very difficult. And ultimately, what it really leads me to is the need for reparations. We need to be fully made whole so that we can have our own communities, have our own spaces where we feel comfortable, that we are recognized in our fullest humanity, that where we are just affirmed. And so ultimately, I think for me, and this is a conclusion that I came to probably within the last 5 years, is that we need reparations. I've always known about it because my parents and I have always talked about it ever since I was a small child. We've talked about our 40 acres and a mule. But within the last 5 years, it is something that I think is absolutely necessary, and that is from me having seen our people linger on the streets of downtown Los Angeles. It is just a horrible sight to see, Kenneth. Horrible. Mm.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I think that issue is all over the country. Go ahead, Michonne.
Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Hi, Michonne.
Okay. My first part is, President Abraham Lincoln issued an Emancipation Proclamation in the fall of 1862. And it took effect on January 1st of 1863, and the amendment was not ratified by Congress until December of 1865, and many blacks were not given or told of these changes, and this information was kept from them because there were people who still wanted another harvest. So my question is, why is freedom and justice delayed for black people?
You know what? We are the bodies that they've used to build the country. We are the foundation of this country. If you remove the foundation, then everything crumbles. So in short, that's my answer. They've used us as an economic base, as a means by which they have produced wealth. And they need to keep us as a bottom caste in order to maintain that power and wealth. You need black bodies in prisons in order to maintain salaries, for companies to produce the clothing that's necessary and the sheets that are necessary.
Okay, could you explain to me the monetary sanction?
In terms of what, Michonne?
Okay, like when a person comes in contact with the judicial system.
Okay.
Okay. We have fees, fines, and
things
that
you need to do. Oh, that's an excellent question. Oh, Michonne, let me tell you. Okay, something I do now are foster care cases. And one of the things I have to determine is if folks who are family members to children should be able to foster their own relative child or grandchild. I had a woman come before me about a month ago who had completed drug treatment as required by the court and all the other conditions, but she had two conditions that she had not met, and that was she hadn't paid her restitution and she hadn't paid her fines. Her restitution was like $5,000, and she was paying $20 per month. In order for her to have her grandchildren, Michonne, she had to have paid off her fines. Do you think she would ever pay off her fines if she's paying $20 a month?
No.
For a $5,000 restitution? So
no.
She's paying $20 a month with restitution at $5,000. She would never pay that off. So that meant she would never, and in order to have your grandchildren or your child, you have to have passed probation. You have to have successfully completed probation. So these things serve as a hindrance to us, not only in criminal justice, but in the ability to move on with our lives, with the ability for us to have the right to foster our own children and grandchildren. You can't tell me that's not horrible.
It is horrible. That brings me to my next question. I know the consequences are huge for people who are poor when they make contact with our system of justice. And there's court supervision, like you said, until debt is paid. And some states have a provisional right to vote, which was enacted in 2009. So as long as they're making consecutive payments on legal financial obligations, you will have the right to vote. Isn't this essentially a poll tax?
Absolutely. 100% it is a poll tax. You know, my grandfather has gone on to be with the Lord, but he would tell me about the sheriff coming up to his home in Lena, Louisiana. It's a small town in central Louisiana. And he'd say, Mr. Allen, if you can tell me, you know, how many pennies are in this jar, then, you know, I'll bring your ballot to you. And that is something that we are experiencing now. Our vote is being denied to us. It is absolutely a poll tax to require someone to essentially pay a fine or a debt in order to vote. It's absurd.
Yeah, it's been like that for a long time.
Right. And also on April 8th in 1864, according to the Library of Congress, the Senate passed the 13th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment has been used to continue forced labor that was ratified in 1865. Well, and it also said the system of monetary sanctions is a form of social control that has been in place since enslavement. And the slaveholders had control of black bodies that allowed them to profit off our ancestors' labor. And also, the 13th Amendment allowed enslavement to those who are duly convicted. Do you think that the 13th Amendment is a failure?
Absolutely. Absolutely, 100%. You know, I am happy to say that, I'm kind of like, I'm not going over your question, but there's something that I need to share that's very important, and that is this has been a problem, the use of prisoners to do work or the use of prison labor. Let's face it. Kamala Harris, our current vice president, continued to use firefighters to fight fires in the state of California, firefighters who are inmates, California state prison inmates. And some of these inmates, it was discovered, had to continue to essentially be incarcerated in order to fight fires when they could have been released to, you know, begin living their lives. That is and should be illegal. And in the state of California, one of the legislators, I think her last name is Comlinger, introduced a bill, ACA 3, I think it is, that prohibits this sort of conduct. It needs to stop. And inmates who fight these fires need to be given the opportunity to actually, upon release, be able to apply for jobs as a firefighter. You're telling me they can fight the fires while inmates or custody of the state, but upon release they can't fight fires when they serve their time? It makes no sense.
Yeah, and again,
exactly.
How can you uphold a system that think that has those type of policies for us, whether it's the economic system, the criminal justice system, or the educational system? How can you uphold a system that's not in our favor?
You know, Kenneth and Michonne, you guys are just really asking some very important questions. And I will tell you, as a person within the system, it is a dichotomy, a paradox that I deal with every day. How do I work within a system with policies, practices, and laws that are just absolutely contrary to what I believe in? And all that I can tell you is that as a woman who, and I am Christian, I am not one of those proselytizing Christians, but I am a spiritual person who reads the Bible, studies the Bible, and one of the things that I wholeheartedly believe is that as the prophet in the Bible called out the king, they called out the king, we need to call out the king, and the king represents the government, the systems that exist.
Right.
And so what I'm telling you is that on the inside, I need to, my colleagues need to, call out those things that are wrong.
But they're not, though. Hey, we're going to get to them colleagues in a few minutes. We're going to get to black professionals in a few minutes. You spoke of reparations earlier. Do you really think that we're going to get reparations from this country? I don't care how the litigation, the protests, and the civil disobedience, do you think, and all three phases has been addressed when it comes to reparations. Do you really think that black folks don't get, now other cultures have received reparations, but do you really think that black folks gonna get reparations?
Ooh, Kenneth, you say, do I really think?
Yes.
And you know what? I have devoted probably the last 2 years of my life to pushing for it. And I will tell you, I really honestly don't have to. I'm not in a position where I am financially hurting. But what I do know is that when I look into the eyes of the elderly folk that I see when I go into my mama and daddy's hometown in Louisiana, and I see the pain from their inability to live the life that they should have been able to live, when I look into the eyes of black children who I know will not have the opportunities that they need in order to live the abundant life that I deserve, I have to have hope, and I have to continue to push. So to answer your question, I continue to push, and I am part of a reparationist organization because I believe that we will be victorious.
Probably in another 100 years, if this earth is still in existence, the way we're destroying the earth. Now, we spoke of black professionals. You spoke of your coworkers and your colleagues. I know there's social workers, CEOs, lawyers, and what have you, and other professionals that are associated with the criminal justice system, halfway houses, and what have you. Now, my question is, why do so many, you spoke of this community in Louisiana, and you see the hurt in people's eyes. Last week, I had a woman on from D.C. that spoke of so many issues in Ward 7 in D.C. And then you have Baltimore. Then you have all of these cities or black suburbs now or black little towns that are hurting. Why are so many black folks moving out of these communities instead of addressing the issues and rebuilding the community? But I can remember in the 70s when I went off to school or what have you, the main thing that was spoken to me, when you get your paper, come back to the community and rebuild, build up, build a nation within the nation. What happened?
Kenneth, you are just asking some amazing questions, and these questions could almost, I could expound on them, but to answer your question directly, the hood is no more. The hood has been gentrified. I grew up and raised in the hood of South Los Angeles. Wonderful community when I grew up. Best childhood one could have. I tell my mama every day, I was climbing trees on top of houses, hanging out with friends. You had the lady down the street tell you to get your behind in the house. You go to another neighbor. And listen, and my parents were working class. If my mama needed $5, she would send me two doors down to the old folks to get the $5 she needed to carry us through the week. It was a beautiful community of black people. And, of course, as we all know, drugs hit. Crack cocaine hit our community. And it decimated our community. It decimated it such that the young men that I was looking for in my neighborhood after I graduated from law school, where did I find them? I found them in California State's prison, in the prisons throughout the state, at San Quentin, Soledad, CIM, in L.A. County Jail. That's where they were. Folks were cracked out. And so now you go back into the community where I once lived, and it is no more. And when I say it's no more, what I mean by that, those houses that my mom and daddy paid $15,000 for, fully furnished in the 70s, early 70s, are now $700,000 because
right.
They will be close to the stadium in Inglewood where the Raiders will be playing. And it has pushed us out of our own community. And I know that sounds dire and sad, but it's just the truth.
Well, Jacob, but now since a lot of black folks has been displaced in this country, we're moving into different towns and we're becoming the predominant populations in those towns where the other culture moved out back into where we were living. Okay. Now, how can we prevent from making the same mistakes that we did to lose our communities as we, like, for example, the people in Harlem, New York, the people in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn was black since the 1800s and now no more. Everybody know about Harlem. Now all these black folks are moved out the South Bronx. They made movies about the South Bronx, for God's sake. Now they moved out into areas that used to be known as white areas like Rochester, Buffalo, and other towns like that. You know, okay, we're there now. You know, okay, it happened. All right. Now, how can we prevent from making the same mistakes that we did while we had the Harlem and the Bed-Stuy, D.C.? D.C. used to be called Chocolate City.
That's right. I remember. That used to be my old stomping ground.
Right. And Atlanta is the black folks is about to lose Atlanta in the next mayoral election. You know, so how can we, and black folks are moving out into, they're getting displaced in Atlanta into these suburbs, you know, Gwinnett County, DeKalb County, what have you. Now, how can we prevent from making the same mistakes? We're there now. You know, So they're not gonna let us back in. You know, rents are like $2,000, $2,500 a month. You know, they're not gonna let us back in. So what can we do to prevent from making the same mistakes as we did when we had these different historical sections of cities and urban centers?
You are just asking some amazing questions. I'm just like, oh my God, this man is just touching upon everything that I have been thinking about and wanting to really deal with. Okay, so my dad is from Houston, Texas, and his family still owns a home in Independence Heights, which is the very first black town in Houston, Texas. He and his siblings have not sold their family property. That family property is now next to a Harley-Davidson and a Whole Foods market. And so they've been pushing every year.
Which has become very popular for organic foods.
Yes, yes. And so they want that property. They want that property bad. And I've been telling Dad, I said, Daddy, please don't sell. Don't sell. Don't sell. I said, you know, then they want to offer $70,000 in property, and the land is worth at least three times that. And I told him, I said, Daddy, let me buy it. Let me buy it, Daddy. Let me buy it. I'll get my money together. Let me buy it. And his issue is Marjorie, it just, you know how families fight. And families argue over property that's left over. Sweetheart, I don't want you to get involved in all that. And so to answer your question, ultimately, I believe that we need to hold on to what we have. Land is important. Property is important. And when we sell Big Mama's house, when we sell Papa's house, it does, we get that little money and it goes so quickly. And we have nothing to show for it. Hold on to it, just like they hold on to stuff. Hold on to it.
And pass it down.
Pass it down. That's right. If you choose to not use it, fine, but you can rent it out to other family members. You can garden on it. You can even build commercial property if that's your choice. But hold on to it. Pay the taxes on it. Put it in a trust, so that the family comes to a decision on what is going to happen to the property. But those who want their piece of the pie, let's pay them off. Pay them out and, you know, let them have their money so that you can, you know, keep the property within the family. So that is my response to that. I hate to hear that we sell property, specifically when we don't have to. It's different if we need that money. But when you
you're saying when we move into these new towns like Rochester, Gwinnett County, and even Philadelphia, we're losing Philadelphia because I produced a show in Philadelphia with Carlton, and I used to hang out in this area called North Philadelphia, and they said North Philly is no more. Matter of fact, they get ready to change the name from North Philadelphia to Templetown, because Templetown bought a lot of property in North Philadelphia. So you're saying that when we go into these new areas, these new towns, we need to buy a property, buy land, and how about build businesses? How about making it a new village?
Absolutely. You know, if I had money, I'd go up and buy everything I could in Detroit. 85, 90-year-old client of mine said to me, Marjorie and Mr. Clifford, he said, if you want to make some money, if you want to really, really do some good, you go in and buy those old properties in Detroit. I know they're going to be fixer-uppers, but just buy them and just hold on to them. And, you know, that's important. You know, if we're able to do that, go in and buy these properties that are vacated, these pieces of land that folks claim they don't want, because that's what they're doing. They're buying this stuff up, and they're going to build it and displace us. That's what's going to happen.
No, well, they're already doing it. They're already doing it. Go ahead, Michonne.
Okay. I do have another question. Okay. It has to do with another reason why people, you know, want to leave the hood. I was talking to some people who left the hood recently,
mm-hmm.
actually today. And some of the things that they mentioned to me why they left the hood was they said, you know, since they came up, as they put it, they said they didn't want to live in an area or raise their kids where they talked about the schools, not having good quality schools.
Yeah, that's
they were talking about gangs in the neighborhood. That there wasn't no jobs in the hood. So where they worked and in the hood, they'd have to commute. And they said they felt like it was a sense of confinement there.
You know what? I must admit that if I had the opportunity to move back to South Central LA, where I lived, and raise my family there, I would have to seriously take that into consideration, all the things you've mentioned, primarily schools.
Yeah.
And
look at this,
I think,
out, Your Honor. Hold up, both of you. I got to interject here. I have to interject right now, okay? No one reason why black folks move out. Hey, I'm talking about black folks. Black folks that's not forced out, but black folks decide they got a couple quarters to rub together and they decide to move out because they're able to move out. And you cite the educational system. Well, how about staying in that community and changing the curriculum in the predominantly black school? We got black superintendents now. We got a lot of black teachers. We got black principals. We got black commissioner of education, commissioner of state education. You know, moving, you know, if something's wrong in your community, and this is what this show is all about, find a solution. Address the problem. Even we have to build new schools. A lot of black small business owners, a lot of black advocates are going into starting their own schools, you know, that have the STEM curriculum, that have an Afrocentric curriculum. Why can't we do that? How come other black professionals can't do that, do the same?
My uncle was a principal at a school, and he stayed in the neighborhood.
Exactly. You guys are just amazing because I'm going to tell you this. If I had not been a lawyer, I would have been an educator. And I studied Jawanza Kunjufu, and I
the conspiracy to destroy black boys. Yeah, it came out in the mid-80s. Yeah, I'm aware.
And so to answer your question, it is a very, very difficult thing for me to put my child in a place or in a system where I know that she is not going to get everything I think she needs. Now, if I were able to be in the system with her, with him, educating him or her in the hood, I'd be okay with that because I know that I would make sure that my children are getting the education that they need. But not being in that system where I'm relying on other people, it for me is not a good feeling. Above anything else, for me, educating my child is probably up there with interest and with goals. It's just like up there. Like literally right now, my child is on the piano playing and having her lesson. We are constantly in a household where we are learning. And so I just would not feel comfortable. I'm just going to be quite frank. Putting my child in a system where I lack.
You mean to tell me that same family that you have, a paradigm pandemic family in the so-called hood. You mean to tell me that family is unable to learn because of its environment?
You know what, Kenneth?
I'm
yes
say yes.
No. Let me tell you what I've done. I'm part of an organization of Black parents, and we do Saturday and Sunday schools. And I don't mean Sunday schools as in church, but we educate our children outside of the system. They come together every 2 weeks for education on a broad range of subjects, from Black liberation, Black freedom fighters, to passing standardized tests, to how to operate their own business. The unfortunate thing about this education is that it is limited to children who have a certain amount of means. And it's not expensive, but you need to be able to get to the campus. It's conducted on a college campus. You need to be able to get there every 2 weeks to participate in the education. And
okay.
I don't like that every child, every Black child, is not able to receive the supplemental academic and cultural education that my child is receiving. It bothers me.
Well, how about taking the college campus to the hood?
Excellent idea.
What we call in other professions, satellite programs. How about taking or starting your own program that's similar, but I think it's great taking kids from the hood and expose them to the college campus. I think it's great. And they can get there if they want to now. They can get everywhere else. They can go to amusement parks. It's just that, again, certain parents have to motivate other parents to get their children into new experiences. You know, and that is another thing. That's another issue. But, you know, there are some parents in our communities that are not very motivated and really don't know how to operate a family. So therefore, it takes other parents, like a mentoring, like a parenting mentorship, to motivate other parents to expose their children to other experiences. I want to ask you one question, and then I'll return. Back to Michonne, and I apologize for interjecting at that point, but I just had to get that out. And the listeners, if you have a comment, if you have a question, press one, because we have a lot of listeners. Do you support? Now, there are some academic scholars in this country that came up with this theory called the separation theory, the economic and social separation theory. How do you feel about separations?
Kenneth, that's kind of sounding like some 10% W.E.B. Du Bois type position. That there is a special
Boys. There's a whole lot of scholars out there. Ivan Sternema. There's a whole lot of John Henry Clark. There's a whole lot of scholars that are no longer with us, and they are still present that talk about separation. What do you think about separations?
You mean separating from main society, as Black folks separating from main society?
No,
or
Black
are you talking
folks
about
their own?
Choosing.
Black folks having their own political party. Black folks having their own economic system, like the Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn, and like the Koreans, like other cultures, having their own educational schools, like what you just talked about. There's a problem in mainstream that is run by our government that are not teaching our children. You know, so like LeBron James started his own school, and great shout out to him. But yes, social, political, economic separation. Not a physical separation, more of a separation of having our own, which is part of liberation and independence. Not independent.
Well, we had it, Kenneth. We had it when we were forced to have it, when we were not integrated. When I grew up in the hood, I went to an all-black school, high-performing.
Your Honor, you're trying to say we was more productive pre-civil rights?
Well, shame the truth. Tell the truth and shame the devil. I can only speak on my lived experience, and that is from like the 70s through the 80s. And I know that from my parents, who were part of the generation who was allowed to integrate, to begin integrating into quote-unquote mainstream society, they, in my opinion, integrated in terms of employment. They got their jobs through government or white corporations. But in terms of socialization, we were limited to our hood. We were limited to our black church. We were part of
a lot of our hoods were doing well then, until, like you said, until the crack era hit in the 80s.
And I think
the crack era was not by accident. It was more by design to lead up to gentrification and to displace black folks and to make the prison system more wealthy.
Absolutely. Kenneth, I keep a picture in my Bible, a picture of me at 16 years old, and I wish I had brought the picture to show you. It is a picture of me at 16 years old rocking a child at the Dangerfield Institute of Urban Problems. This child was had HIV, drug addicted, blind, deaf. And every month I would go with my youth group to this home to rock my baby. She was my baby, not my physical child, but we were in And that child, and when I was 17, I went off to college. I went off to the University of Colorado at Boulder on scholarship. And I came home and wanted to see my baby, the baby that I was nursing caring for each month. And that baby died. And I keep that a picture of her in my Bible to remind me of what I will always fight for, and that is the full humanity and respect for our people. That child was addicted to drugs because her mother was addicted to drugs, because her father was incarcerated and could not care for her. And it is a constant reminder to me that we must really, and let me tell you this, this is something that is so amazing to me. This woman who was an LVN, now LVN are the lower status of nurses. She's not a RN or anybody like that, but this LVN black woman in her 50s quit her job working for the county to open up these homes to rehabilitate black children and babies. And she was able to rehabilitate and care for and nurse back to health so many black children. My baby died. And I always ask myself, God, why would you have me care for a child that was so sick? Why would you do that to me, God? Why couldn't you give me a child that was healthier, that I could see grow? And you know what I learned? This came to me about 5 years ago. God told me that I knew that you could handle it. I knew that you wouldn't run away from that. I don't even know if I'm answering your question, Kenneth.
I'm off
on a tangent.
Well, let me ask you this. And this is a question that popped up in my mind as you were talking. I think Michonne can remember. I had these two brothers on from ADOS from Kentucky. Were they from Kentucky or Texas? I think they were from Kentucky because when that woman got shot, forgot her name. But anyway, they said that. They were in the military. They was ex-military men. That the police, if the police was in the, it was a military unit in another country. They will be taken to the Geneva Convention because the police break a lot of human rights laws. Now, remember that term, human rights. Malcolm said that we can never get our just due from the American court system. And these two brothers said the same thing. How do you feel about taking the United States of America to the international courts to get our human rights? Oh, the call dropped. Oh, well, we Sean?
Yes.
The call has dropped on that question. Wow.
Oh, wow. That's...
Call back, Miss Melvin. But I guess she couldn't answer that question because I don't want to put her position in jeopardy. But we only have 3 minutes left. What's going on your show tomorrow night, LeSean?
Well, I'm trying to get this. Well, this lady's supposed to come on.
She's back.
I'm sorry about that. I'm not quite sure what happened.
I thought my question ran you off.
No.
We only
to answer your question, you know, I just don't think it would work because it is just too broad to take. Our claim to the United Nations, an entity that lacks power, that is essentially controlled by the United States government, would not be the most effective means. They lack the power to give us our just due, to make the debt that is owed to us right. So I believe that the appropriate place would be the United States government, and specifically legislation, because as our brother Johnny Cochran discovered, the courts have dismissed our claim in the courts for lack of standing. They claim that we as the progeny of enslaved people in America, we're not the proper plaintiffs. We're not the proper party. We cannot bring this claim because we were not injured.
We weren't injured?
Well, that's the claim of the courts, that we lack standing, that we cannot bring the claim because we were not injured. Yeah, that is their claim, that we are not the injured party. The injured party is, according to them, the enslaved people who are no longer with us, who couldn't have brought the claim.
Right.
If they had brought the claim, they would have endured the riots that we endured, the massacres that we endured, like in Rosewood and in other places, in Colfax, Louisiana. So, yeah, that is their claim. So, as you know, there is a legislation currently pending it is currently pending in United States government to study reparations, and that is H.R. 40. And we have a long way to go. I recognize that. But
H.R. 40 has been around for like two decades.
I know. It has.
Well, Your Honor, we only got like less than 60 seconds. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to thank everybody for listening. I guess people had their pencil paper out and obtain all the knowledge and wisdom that you have. And I really would like to invite you back in the near future. And I think you have a lot to offer our audience. And I thank you so much.
I thank you, too. I thank both of you, Michonne and Kenneth. This has been an amazing experience, and I thank you for having me.
Thank you. And next time you come on, I want to hear about Angela Davis. That's it, y'all.
We'll tell you about that. Okay.
We made another week. As always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night.
Hold it now.
Good night.